Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 30th of September. Our main stories. 4 months after a scandal brought down his government, Sebastian Kurz will lead Austria once again. There's more violence in Hong Kong ahead of a landmark anniversary in China. And Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, says a no-deal Brexit can happen regardless of a law to stop it, even as newspapers publish claims about his private life. Also in the podcast. Known as the Prince of Song, one of Latin America's best-known singers, José José, has died. 4 months after a scandal involving his far-right coalition partner forced him from office, Sebastian Kurz looks set to return as Austrian Chancellor. Exit polls gave his People's Party a resounding victory in the general election. Joy from supporters at party headquarters, and a short time later, they heard from their 33-year-old leader.
Mir fehlen selten die Worte, aber heute ist es soweit. Ich bin fast sprachlos.
I'm really lost for words, but today, so far, I'm almost speechless. We were looking forward to the day and we had expected a good result, but of course we could not expect such a good result. I really want to take the opportunity to thank voters for their trust.
The People's Party were projected to get 37% of the vote, but Mr. Kurz may have to find a new coalition partner after his former allies, the Nationalist Freedom Party, finished third, losing 10% of its vote. That was no doubt in large part thanks to Ibizagate, the scandal which saw the party leader filmed promising government contracts to a woman posing as the niece of a Russian oligarch. However, as our correspondent in Vienna, Bethany Bell, explains, Mr. Kurz has come out of it untouched.
Stronger than he was before the scandal. 37% is quite a lot more than he got last time round. So yes, he has emerged well from it. And some people are arguing maybe that was his strategy all along, to bring the far right in, try and tame it, and then when they got too difficult to move along and try and form another type of coalition. But it came at a big price. He lost a vote of no confidence, but the Austrian population tonight certainly has given him a strong mandate to try and form the next coalition government. But the big question, of course, will be who he does that with.
Yeah, I see a line that the Austrian far right says it's preparing for opposition after it did so badly in this election. So what might a coalition look like?
He has several options. I mean, the Freedom Party is a possibility. In terms of content, that would probably be the easiest coalition to try and put together. They've both taken a very strong line against migrants, for example. But then this was such a slap in the face for the Freedom Party. They may want to go into opposition and build up from them. And in fact, as a populist party, they've often thrived better out of government than they have done in government. The other option for Mr. Kurz is a grand coalition with the centre-left Social Democrats. That's thought to be not very likely because of bad relations between the Social Democrat leadership and Mr. Kurz. What he may try and do, which would be a first for Austria, is form some kind of pact with the Greens, who did very well. They weren't in Parliament at all this time, and now they've got about 14%. He might be able to do just a coalition with them, or he may try a three-way pact with the Greens and with the Liberal Neos, which would be a first in Austria. But while Mr. Kurz has shown himself to be ideologically flexible, there will be many in the Green Party who don't like his anti-migrant tone and his more right-wing policies.
Bethany Bell in Vienna. There have been running street battles between riot police and protesters in Hong Kong in some of the worst violence in nearly 4 months of anti-government unrest. The latest clashes came on Sunday as Communist China prepared to celebrate its 70th anniversary. Thousands of people in the former British colony defied the authorities to join a pro-democracy march. Our correspondent John Sudworth sent this report from Hong Kong.
With just 2 days to go before China's big anniversary, Hong Kong is decidedly off message. With the central business district echoing to the sound of rubber bullets and petrol bombs and disappearing for large parts of the day into clouds of tear gas. While in Beijing, rehearsals are in full swing for a celebration of 70 years of communist rule, intended to send a message of unity and strength. In Hong Kong, there's division, uncertainty and fear. For the protesters, this is a city now at the centre of a global clash between authoritarianism and freedom. For their critics, they are hurting the economy and only provoking Beijing, risking even further intervention in the city's affairs. The police made multiple arrests, chasing protesters and wrestling them to the floor. But on Tuesday, the day of the anniversary, they say they'll be back to spoil China's big party.
John Sudworth in Hong Kong. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has again put himself on a collision course with his opponents in Parliament by insisting the UK can leave the EU next month without an agreement, despite a law passed by MPs preventing that happening. But in a BBC interview on the first day of the Conservative Party conference in Manchester, Mr. Johnson refused to explain how he would bypass the law if he couldn't get a deal. He didn't rule out using emergency powers or even relying on EU legislation to challenge the act. Mr. Johnson said Britain must leave on October the 31st.
The best thing for the country and the best thing for people's overall psychological health would be to get Brexit done. And that's not just I who think that. If you look at the where the public is, where people are, whether they voted leave or remain, they really think that it's up to Parliament now to get this thing over the line.
I asked our political correspondent Rob Watson if the conference was aimed at firing up the pro-Brexit wing of the party.
Very much, Oliver. And I think when the history of this period is written, I think one of the most extraordinary and striking things will be what's happening before our very eyes. And that is, this conference is seeing the completion of the transformation of the Conservative Party from a party that once believed in membership of the European Union to an absolute out-and-out Brexit party. And of course, the reason the party has gone this way is that it believes, certainly the people leading it believe, that the party's very survival depends on delivering Brexit.
Yeah, and the Prime Minister still insisting Britain will leave the EU on the 31st of October. What are the chances of a deal?
I think the chances are looking fairly slim. I mean, of course, these things change from minute to minute, Oliver, but I mean, slim in the sense that the noises coming from Brussels are not very optimistic, and slim in the sense that even if there were to be a deal agreed between Boris Johnson and the European Union, that the political atmosphere in the UK is now so bad. I mean, I think everyone will have heard of the dreadful scenes, the anger in Parliament last week, and it's incredibly hard to see parliamentarians agreeing to any deal put forward to them by Boris Johnson.
Meanwhile, Mr. Johnson facing more headlines about his relationship with an American businesswoman, Jennifer Akuri, but his supporters probably don't care.
No, they don't. I mean, I think in that sense, there are parallels with the supporters of Donald Trump and his base in the United States. Here in the UK, if you're a Brexiteer and if you like Boris Johnson, you know, you tend to think, yeah, this is all a plot by Remainers to somehow try and discredit him. So whatever mud that gets slung at him, I think it just tends to slide down the wall.
Rob Watson. And since I spoke to Rob, some of the British newspapers have picked up on another allegation against the Prime Minister. Downing Street has denied a claim that Boris Johnson squeezed a female journalist's thigh under the table at a private lunch some 20 years ago. But a cabinet minister earlier told Channel 4 News here in Britain he thought the woman involved, Charlotte Edwards, was credible. Our political correspondent Chris Mason sent us this update from the Conservative Party conference in Manchester.
Charlotte Edwards, who is a columnist for the Sunday Times, in her first column for that newspaper today, made an allegation that 20 years ago, when Mr. Johnson was the editor of the Spectator magazine and she was a young journalist, they were at a lunch in which they were sat together, and Mr. Johnson, she alleges, had put his hand on her thigh, high up her leg. Now, tonight, Downing Street have said that that allegation is untrue, but Charlotte Edwards has said in response that that must mean that she has a better memory than Mr. Johnson. Into the mix on this story, Matt Hancock, who is the health secretary, said tonight that he knows Charlotte Edwards well and regards her as entirely trustworthy.
I know Charlotte well and I entirely trust what she has to say.
You believe her when she says he grabbed her upper thigh?
Well, I know her and I know her to be trustworthy. What I would say is that these are important issues and getting the response right is incredibly important.
And Amber Rudd, who was in Boris Johnson's cabinet until a matter of weeks ago, but then resigned and also left the Conservative Parliamentary Party, said that she agreed with Mr. Hancock. So Mr. Johnson facing some awkward questions, albeit about something that happened quite some time ago, but for Mr. Johnson's critics will raise questions about his judgment.
Chris Mason in Manchester. Tributes have been paid to the Mexican singer-songwriter José José, who's died from pancreatic cancer at the age of 71. The Cuban-American singer Gloria Estefan said he wrung out our hearts with his unmistakable voice and left an indelible mark on music for all time. Viv Marsh looks back at the life of a Latin American superstar.
He renunciado a ti porque es pura fantasía nuestro amor.
Prince of Song was, for five decades, the healer of broken hearts across Latin America. José José rose to fame in the 1970s with a string of heartfelt romantic ballads for the jilted and the lovelorn.
Qué triste fue decirnos adiós.
José Rómulo Sosa came from a family of musicians in Mexico City and began singing in his early teens. Reporting his death, the Mexican Culture Ministry described him as one of the nation's most beloved voices. José José was credited with inspiring a generation of musicians, including the singer Julio Iglesias. He sold more than 120 million records.
El Triste by José José, ending that report by Viv Marsh. And still to come on the podcast.
Here at Bonmont, the Bonham sale at Bonmont, 7,200,000 and going. 7,200,000.
A Playboy's luxury cars are auctioned off in aid of Equatorial Guinea. A former senior prosecutor in Ukraine has rejected a suggestion by Donald Trump that the authorities in Kiev should investigate the family of the US president's Democratic rival, Joe Biden. Yuri Lutsenko said there was no basis for an inquiry into Mr. Biden or his son's business activities in Ukraine. Our correspondent in Kiev, Jonah Fisher, is following the story.
Joe Biden promised Ukraine $1 billion if they fired the prosecutor investigating his son's company.
President Trump has been claiming, most recently in this video tweeted from his account, that the Biden family's activities in Ukraine need to be investigated. That when Joe was vice president, he intervened to get a Ukrainian official sacked because he was investigating the energy company that his son Hunter was a director of. In a phone call with Ukraine's leader, the contents of which were published last week, President Trump called for the Bidens to be investigated. But there's been no credible evidence to support President Trump's claims, and Yuri Lutsenko, the former prosecutor general, blew another big hole in the story.
Have you got any evidence that Joe Biden acted in any way which supported Hunter Biden's company, Burisma?
It is not my jurisdiction.
But have you got any?
It is not my jurisdiction. I can't do nothing which because is not connected with Ukrainian law.
So under Ukrainian law, you've got nothing?
Nothing, certainly.
Mr. Lutsenko's words won't help President Trump's attempts to turn attention away from his own behaviour and onto the Bidens. With the impeachment inquiry beginning in Washington, it's likely there will be increased scrutiny of what Mr. Lutsenko's friend and President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, has been up to in Ukraine.
Jonah Fisher in Kiev. People living in Indian-administered Kashmir have been cut off from mobile and internet networks for more than 50 days after a security clampdown by the Indian authorities. Some human rights groups argue it is an infringement of the people's human rights. But the Indian Home Minister Amit Shah has rejected that. India has deployed thousands of extra troops in the Muslim-majority region after revoking its special status. I asked our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etirajan how people there were coping with being cut off.
It has been a terrible situation for the residents of the Indian-administered Kashmir. There are 8 million people. And in the 21st century, it is hard to imagine people lived without landline telephones, mobile phones and internet connections. And they were not even allowed to move from one area to another for weeks. And they also didn't have any cable television. And I spoke to a couple of people and they were explaining how they were using their old radios, trying to find so that they can understand what was happening outside Kashmir in the outside world, because there was a total blackout of communication and also the curfew and various restrictions. Now, the government says it has now eased some of these restrictions, particularly regarding movement of people, even though still there are some restrictions apply. And the landlines, the government says it has been restored in most areas. But for example, I have been trying to reach a friend in Srinagar for the last few weeks. Even the landline, it doesn't seem to work. And the mobile and internet connections are still suspended. That is the most important thing, because in the last 10-15 years, this has given an opportunity for the Kashmiri people. You know, this region has been torn by violence for the last 3 decades, and there is an active separatist movement going on. So people are using the social media to communicate and also find out about the relatives in other parts of the country or within Kashmir. So people are still without mobile and internet, and that's why many rights groups have condemned or criticized the Indian government, saying, no, this is a violation of basic right. People should have or the ability to communicate with each other.
So what is the Indian government's argument for cutting off this communication?
The Indian Home Minister Amit Shah is one of the senior leaders of the Hindu nationalist BJP, which governs the country. And they were justifying all these moves by saying, by allowing this communication, by allowing people to move freely, it will trigger more protests, which means many lives will be lost in the clashes. And that was the reason why they say they imposed these restrictions. But now, more than 50 days have passed. Indian Home Minister was justifying, they saying, no, not having a telephone is not a human rights violation. And these restrictions were imposed only to save lives. You know, people can live without mobile phones for a few days. But again, this is coming from a man who is known to take a very strong decisions. And he's also one of the ideologues of the, you know, BJP. But many people would differ from his views. And he was also criticizing India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru's decision to take this Kashmir issue to the UN. Because when India gained independence, many regions were divided between India and Pakistan. India was Hindu majority and Pakistan was Muslim majority. But the ruler of the Kashmir region decided to join with India, whereas the many people disagreed with his view. And then the clashes started. And that's why Kashmir is divided between India and Pakistan. Both countries are claiming the territory in full.
Anbarasan Etirajan. Police in Saudi Arabia say that King Salman's personal bodyguard has been shot dead during a row. He died on Saturday. Sasha Schlichter reports.
Major General Abdul Aziz Al Fagm was visiting a friend's house in the Red Sea port city of Jeddah, several kilometres north of the palace where the ailing King Salman spends his summer months. Police said a row erupted with another friend who was present. He then left the room, came back with a gun and opened fire. 5 security officers were also wounded. Police surrounded the house, but the shooter refused to surrender and was shot dead. General Fagm was taken to hospital, where he died of his wounds. For the past few years, King Salman has ruled largely in name only. The real decision-maker in Saudi Arabia is his all-powerful and many say ruthless son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Before becoming King Salman's personal bodyguard, the general served in the same capacity for his half-brother, the late King Abdullah.
Sasha Schlichter. On the podcast yesterday, we reported on the dangers facing voters in Afghanistan. Well, early estimates from Saturday's presidential election suggest only a fifth of the electorate actually turned out. So what's it like to live with the prospect of violence day in, day out? And what if you're a young Afghan who's only ever known war? Kudrat Wasfi and Arsene Fahim are 2 young musicians in Kabul who are finding ways to cope.
My name is Arsen Fahim. I'm 19 years old. I'm a musician. I play the piano. I'm also a composer, and I conduct the Afghan National Symphony Orchestra. It was August 7th. First, I didn't know what it was, just a huge sound kind of just shook us, and almost like we felt a push, and suddenly everybody was running everywhere. It was an explosion very near our school, like walking distance from our school, and it actually killed a lot of people. This was very interesting that, like, after a few hours when the orchestra had a rehearsal, everybody was back to practicing, like nothing had happened. I guess it's become natural to us.
My name is Kudrat Wasfi. I'm 20 years old. I'm a trumpeter, composer, and a teacher in the Afghanistan National Institute of Music. One day I took my trumpet and I and my friends walked above a hill, and then my friend told me to take out my trumpet and play something for Kabul, because always people are listening the violence sound, the war sound, the fights, the attacks, and all those negative things. We thought this would be a better thing, this would be a struggle and a battle for the Kabul and for Afghanistan's people. I played a very famous song of Afghanistan, which is Dazmung Ziba Watan, my beautiful country. I decided to pick up the trumpet because I was thinking that this is a real and live instrument, so I then decided to play the trumpet and to express my feeling and to be a song for the all countries.
When I was a kid, I knew there was this thing called the piano, and I just wanted to see it. I wasn't even sure if I wanted to learn it, but I wanted to see it. The first time I saw, I remember so vividly entering this room where I could hear the music, and I saw a piano, and the top was open, and it was just so unbelievable that I'm finally seeing this, and I decided just then and there that I want to learn this. I think it was a love at first sight. When I first started music, it was basically an escape for me, an escape from reality. But I think now music is a tool for me to actually see what's happening and to express my opinions. I think I haven't tried to escape war. I've tried to understand it, and I've tried to express how I think it's wrong, how I think it's unjust and unfair.
Gudrat Wasfi and Arsen Fahim from Kabul. At least one person has died in a fire at an overcrowded refugee camp on the Greek island of Lesbos. Police reinforcements were sent in to try to contain an outbreak of violence as migrants reacted angrily to what they saw as the slow response of firefighters. Richard Hamilton reports.
Footage from the Moria camp shows migrants running away and covering their faces after being tear gassed. Police said one burnt body was taken to hospital in the island's capital for identification by the coroner. But there were also unconfirmed reports of another body being found at the containers where the fire had broken out. The police sent reinforcements to the island to try to restore order after clashes broke out between refugees and the police. The migrants were angry that the emergency services had not arrived sooner. Moria is a former army barracks in a remote part of the island, which houses about 12,000 people in tents and shipping containers, four times the number it was designed for. Lesbos has been hit hard by the migrant crisis, with the authorities deadlocked over what to do with new arrivals. Greece has been dealing with a resurgence in refugee and migrant flows in recent weeks from neighbouring Turkey. Nearly a million refugees fleeing the war in Syria crossed from Turkey to the Greek islands back in 2015.
Richard Hamilton. 25 cars have been auctioned off in Switzerland, but they were no ordinary cars. They're among the most expensive in the world and belong to the son of the president of Equatorial Guinea.
This Lamborghini Veneno Roadster is one of only 9 made, introduced to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Lamborghini. This uber rare car has covered only 325 or so kilometres.
And that Lamborghini went for a record $8,300,000. The cars were seized in 2016. To find out more, I spoke to our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt.
Well, they were all rather jazzy than either you or I may be able to afford, and probably more than you'd need on the streets of London. There was plenty to choose from if you had the money. 7 Ferraris, 5 Bentleys, 3 Rolls Royces, a blue Bugatti Veyron, a McLaren, things like Aston Martins, and even a Swedish type of car that I'd never heard of called a Koenigsegg.
Probably more than you would need on the streets of Equatorial Guinea too. Why were they sold?
Well, these cars were confiscated in 2016. They belonged to Teodorin Nguema Obiang. He's the vice president of Equatorial Guinea and the son of Teodoro Obiang Nguema, who's ruled the country since 1979. He's one of the longest standing rulers in Africa. The cars were all confiscated by the Swiss authorities. They were looking into allegations of money laundering and misuse of public funds. Now, they came to an agreement earlier this year in February, whereby Equatorial Guinea paid $1.3 million in terms of the cost of the prosecution to date and agreed that these cars should be auctioned off and the proceeds going to a social fund in Equatorial Guinea. So that was the idea. And in return for that, the investigation was completely dropped.
And so how much money was raised and what kind of things will it benefit?
Well, the amount after not including seller's commission and things like that is about $23 million, so a substantial amount. This is supposed to be monitored, basically. The Swiss Foreign Ministry is to draw up an agreement so that it's spent in a transparent way, because there are fears, obviously, that money might just disappear as well. Now, Equatorial Guinea has a very high per capita GDP, but obviously a high capita GDP doesn't necessarily mean that all people in Equatorial Guinea are rich. In fact, quite the opposite. The CIA factbook says, according to a figure from 2011, that 44% of the people are below the poverty line. I've seen also estimates which are much worse, talking about 60% of the population living on less than a dollar a day. So there's extreme poverty in Equatorial Guinea, contrasting with the extreme wealth that you have in a rich oil-producing nation.
Danny Eberhardt. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Till next time, goodbye.